It'll be mostly, my hope is that you all will get engaged. And I like to put it in the context of one of my favorite terms right now is applied Buddhism. So taking what we do on the cushion and actually moving it out into how do we really take this into the world? How do we engage the world with it? Because I think sometimes it can be very easy to want to say, I'll just go on retreat. Everything will be fine until we hit, you know, college or work or whatever, and there's this huge culture shock or big change because we go from a place of deep quiet or maybe even seclusion to immersion. So I want to explore this facet of how do we actually take what we're learning in our practice into real life, into daily life, where what I would say the rubber meets the road. And so I want to tell you a little story some of you may or may not know about. I'm going to use this other identity of Kuan Yin, which is Avalokiteshvara. And so Avalokiteshvara is one of the most important bodhisattvas in Buddhism, and sometimes is known as the one who hears the cries of the world. And I love the image of Avalokiteshvara because there's this gender change that happens where we have Kuan Yin who has a very feminine appearance, and Avalokiteshvara has some kind of androgynous kinds of characteristics. And so in the context of diversity, in the context of awareness, maybe even we can use the gender pronoun of they rather than he or she. And what is that all about? You know, to consider that here is perhaps an image that he takes elements of the masculine and the feminine and holds those two different roles in the context of compassion. Because sometimes I think maybe there can be an idea that compassion is more feminine. And for men in particular, at least when I teach compassion cultivation, a lot of men go, compassion's kind of weak. And so I like to challenge that with the idea that compassion actually needs a lot of courage and a lot of strength. It takes a lot of strength to be compassionate. So that we need these two different elements of both strong and tender, or strong and caring. And what is that like to put both of those together? So there's an interesting story about Avalokiteshvara in which they vowed never to rest until they had freed all sentient beings from samsara. And despite strenuous effort, they realized that there were still many unhappy beings that were yet to be saved. After struggling to comprehend the needs of so many, their heads split into 11 pieces. And out of compassion, Amitabha took those pieces and put them back together. And so sometimes in the images you'll see that Avalokiteshvara has 11 heads. And upon hearing the cries and seeing the suffering around them, Avalokiteshvara attempted to reach out to all those who needed aid, but found that their two arms were not enough, and they shattered into pieces. And so out of compassion again, Amitabha came and took all those pieces, and those became the arms and the eyes of Avalokiteshvara. So sometimes you'll see these images of 1,000 arms or 1,000 hands and 1,000 eyes. So each hand has an eye to see and to help. So John Dato Lori, who's a Zen practitioner, suggests that every time there's a stranded vehicle on the side of the road and a motorist stops to help, this is an embodiment of Avalokiteshvara. Sometimes in our Buddhist teachings, there's the idea that Avalokiteshvara takes whatever form is needed to assist and be an aid. So we don't know what form that might be. Maybe it's the person that's in your college class. Maybe it's the person that you're going to encounter later today. But there's all different forms and manifestations of Avalokiteshvara. So one of the things that's important with all of these hands and all of these eyes and these ears that can hear the cries of the world is, how do we figure out, how do we see what needs to be done, or if anything needs to be done, or how we can offer aid? And I think that's an interesting question. Because sometimes our eyes are clouded, or the lenses that we see through might be colored. Just as I wear glasses so I can see you better, sometimes we walk around with lenses that we don't see. And so part of today will also be to explore, how do we know that what we're seeing is clear? Or do we have some veil over what we are perceiving or seeing or hearing? How do we know? So there's a verse that comes out of a Zen teaching story from the 9th century. And it's a conversation between Dao Wu and Yunyan. And Yunyan asked Dao Wu what the Bodhisattva of compassion does with so many hands and so many eyes. And Dao Wu answers, "Reaching back at midnight, 1,000 flowing hands and eyes calmly hear all cries and share their pillow with myriad beings." I love that imagery, that we could share our pillow, that it's sometimes just the offering of comfort. Sometimes we can get caught in feeling helpless, as if we don't know what to do. And maybe it's just the adjusting a pillow for someone. So later in the afternoon today, we'll explore how we might transform our sense of helplessness into something that's active, so that we don't get stuck in this place of feeling helpless or overwhelmed. Because one of the places that we can perhaps get mired in is that we can hear and see all the suffering in the world and then feel like we're just crushed by it all. So the other piece that we'll look at today is, how do we transform that, or how do we hold that in a way that actually we can act, rather than feeling like we have no place to go or nothing to do. So that's kind of the terrain of the day. We'll have some breaks during the day as well, and I've planned a little bit of sitting so that we can allow things to settle or integrate through the day. But that's a little bit of where we're headed. Any questions so far? So I want to start with a sutta. So I'm going to pass this around, and I'm going to hand that to Diane. Just take one. And this is a sutta called the Vipalasa Sutta out of the Anguttara Nikaya. So I bet you didn't think you were going to do sutta study today, but we're going to sneak that in. And I looked up a couple of different translations, and the title of this sutta is sometimes called perversions. Sometimes it's called distortions. And for this one, I took Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, in which he calls them inversions. So here's a question that I'm going to ask out to the group. Would somebody like to read the first paragraph, and we can go around? Let's see. I think there's a microphone. Maybe that. You've got it. Okay. So if you want to just kind of send the microphone around, and somebody will read a paragraph at a time, and we'll do the different verses at a time.
Perceiving permanence in the impermanent.
Start with the first paragraph.
I'm sorry. Because there are these four inversions of perception, inversions of mind, and inversions of view. What for? The inversion of perception, mind, and view that takes the impermanent to be permanent. The inversion of perception, mind, and view that takes what is suffering to be pleasurable. The inversion of perception, mind, and view that takes what is non-self to be self. The inversion of perception, mind, and view that takes what is unattractive to be attractive. These are the four inversions of perception, mind, and view.
There are, bhikkhus, these four non-inversions of perception, non-inversions of mind, and non-inversions of view. What for? The non-inversion of perception, mind, and view that takes the impermanent to be permanent, The non-inversion of perception, mind, and view that takes what is suffering to be suffering. The non-inversion of perception, mind, and view that takes what is non-self to be non-self. The non-inversion of perception, mind, and view that takes what is unattractive to be unattractive. These are the four non-inversions of perception, mind, and view.
Perceiving permanence in the impermanent, perceiving pleasure in what is suffering, perceiving a self in what is non-self, and perceiving attractiveness in what is unattractive brings beings resort to wrong views, their minds deranged, their perception twisted.
Such people are bound by the yoke of Mara and do not reach security from bondage. Beings continue in samsara, going to birth and death.
But when the Buddhas arise in the world, sending forth a brilliant light, they reveal this Dharma that leads to the stilling of suffering.
Having heard it, wise people have regained their sanity. They have seen the impermanent as impermanent, and what is suffering as suffering.
Having heard it, they have seen what is non-self as non-self, and the unattractive as unattractive. By the acquisition of right view, they have overcome all suffering.
Okay, so let's just stop there for a moment and kind of let that percolate in for a moment. And let me ask this question. Have any of you ever taken the impermanent to be permanent? I suspect we have. And taking maybe the pleasant as suffering, or rather mistaking suffering for pleasant. Anybody want to give an example of that? So mistaking something that is suffering as pleasant.
Delicious food that has a lot of fats and grease and things like that. Delicious, but afterwards you suffer for that.
Ah, yeah, it could be delicious food that maybe is loaded with fat
and
sugar and all of that.
You can go far and say to see the joy and happiness that people share together and wishing very much that is part of your life.
Oh. Yeah, seeing the joy of somebody else but wishing you have that joy or that you don't have it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, getting caught in the personalization or the identification with it. So I'll give you an example, maybe to clarify that a little bit. Have you ever had somebody who has visited you and you're so happy to see them and then they're leaving? And as they leave, you have this whole thing of, oh, you know, that clinging to what was pleasant and not seeing that in that particular instance. Maybe even thinking that that was pleasant and yet there was suffering in the context of that. To see that just because of the impermanence of that there is suffering. And we might cling to the pleasant, not seeing that clinging is suffering. Does that make sense? Yes. Yeah.
Helping people that are you perceive to be in need or that are suffering, trying to resolve their suffering for them when you haven't been asked to.
And
when you're denying them the consequence of their own meaning and their suffering.
Yeah.
It can be well-meaning, but it can be twisted.
Great. Yeah, so we'll explore that a little bit today, too, about how we know how to offer compassion or what's the right conditions for that. You know? So there's a couple of examples in this next article, and we don't have to read it all together, but let me just kind of highlight a few places. So there's these distortions of perception, distortions of mind, and and distortions of view, or as Bhikkhu Bodhi would say, inversions of perception, inversions of mind, inversions of view that happen. The easiest one is in terms of perception. So for those of you who like to go hiking, maybe you're out for a walk and you see something on the trail and you jump back and you think, that's a snake. So we see something and our perception is that it's something that it isn't. Okay, so that's a distortion of perception. And in this article, so these are translation notes from Andrew Olensky, and Andy has his own translation of this sutta. I happen to like his translation notes, and I happen to like Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. But what happens is that we think about what we've seen. Oh my gosh, it's a snake. And what if it bites me? And so we do this whole thing of papancha, this proliferation of thoughts about the snake that we've seen. This is dangerous, it's probably going to bite me, and if it bites me, I'm far away from the hospital, and I'm probably going to die, and this is terrible. Okay. So that's a distortion of thought. And then there's a distortion of view, and this is really interesting, because now we take these thoughts, and we actually get stuck in them. So we persuade ourselves, that is a snake. I know it's a snake. It's a dangerous snake. It's going to be something terrible. And when we get caught in a distortion of view, even though someone points out, no, it's not moving, it's a stick, we still cling to the view that it's a snake. I bet that you can't come up with any examples of that in our current everyday world. People get stuck in a particular idea, and even though there may be lots of evidence to the contrary, they're unable to see. So this is really interesting that the Buddha, some 2,600 years ago, actually talked about how we can get really twisted in our perceptions, our thoughts, and our views. And the views are the things that are quite dangerous, because people can point it out and say, no, that's not true. And yet we cling tightly to that, despite the evidence. So I think that's really important to see how that comes about. And so this last article, and you know, you can take your time reading these. Actually, we will go through reading this last one, but let me just give you an example. And I'll make a mention to another article, which I didn't print. There's another article that was written by Bonnie Duran, and some of you may know her. She's a very well-known insight meditation teacher. And she wrote an article for Harvard School of Divinity, and she uses this sutta as an example. And she talks about that this also is a place where implicit bias can come up for us. And so it's to see that we have these perceptions based on association. So for example, maybe there was a time that we were hiking and we really did come upon a snake that we mistook for a stick. So we get frightened by it and it really sticks in our mind. The association is, that is a snake because I've been frightened by one before. So it sticks in your mind in that particular way. So we make an association that says, anytime I see something kind of on the trail that looks snake-like, I'm going to really associate that. I may not even know that I'm associating that, but that is how I will see it. Because maybe that was a survival technique, right? That actually kept us safe. But there are other associations that we make that we don't actually necessarily take as survival. So I want to give you an example, very easy one. I'd like you to take your hands and clasp them together. So lace the fingers together. Take a moment and just notice how that feels. Now I'd like you to take your hands apart, and I'd like you to put them back together, but this time lace them the other way. And for some of you, it might have taken you a little longer to figure out how to do that. Right? Great. And I bet for many of you, it feels different. It feels weird. So this is implicit bias at a very simple level. That over all of our years of our lives, we've learned to lace our hands a particular way, and it feels comfortable because we've done it over and over again. The association is, this is the right way, and the other one is, oh, this is the wrong way. Or maybe it's just the weird way. But we learn these associations over time. There's nothing inherently like, oh, you're a bad person because you don't lace them the other way. But there are associations that we pick up and we don't see. We're not aware of them. So at Harvard, there's an organization there that specializes in looking at implicit bias. If you go to there's a website called the Harvard Implicit Bias Test. And they have a bunch of different tests that you can take that are very interesting. And they utilize this particular kind of idea, that the things that we have an implicit bias for come like that. They're very easy. We just easily lace our hands. We don't think about them. And the associations that aren't conditioned or aren't our habit take a little longer, right? So when I said lace your hands the other way, some of you are like, this is kind of interesting. I don't know how to do that, right? So it takes you a fraction of a second longer to lace your hands in a different direction. And so what they do on some of these tests, these implicit bias tests, is they might say, okay, so here are a list of words that we associate as positive words, positive value words. And then we have a bunch of different colored faces, white or black or some other color. And they might say initially, okay, so every time you see a white face, click the positive word. Every time you see a black face, click the negative word. And then they'll mix it up. And they'll say, okay, every time you see a white face, click the negative word. And every time you see a black face, click the positive word. And what happens is they look at the amount of time it takes for you to click. And just like lacing your hands, they see a little bit of a lag when there's a different association that you're not used to. So, depending on your family of origin, your community that you were raised in, the culture that you were raised in, all of that factors into the associations that we make. And sometimes we don't recognize that we may have a favored association. So again, the idea is not to say there's something bad about you because you have this association. It's just to see that we have habituated associations with different kinds of words and faces, or faces and other kinds of actions. So it's really interesting to explore what our biases might be that we don't see. that makes sense. So these are interesting places to explore. So I'd like for us, if it works okay, to read this last article. This is by Ruth King. And maybe wherever the mic ended up, yeah, if you would like to start, and maybe just take that first sentence in the next paragraph, since this that sentence is so short.
Where it says, being mindful of race.
Yeah, so okay. That, yeah.
Being mindful of race, understanding the cycle of misperception, by Ruth King. The radical ignorance and distrust we see in the world today is a reflection of the mind playing itself out in grand scale on the big screen, projecting our collective consciousness, our collective conscious and unconscious conditioning. Every one of our lives represents a mosaic with many shades, shadows, and shapes of experiences.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead and continue with that paragraph.
In our relational world of vast diversity, kinship, and division, we have all been racially conditioned, trained through many generations in how to perceive race, our own and that of others. For example, when we look at people, we often reduce them to a concept or a summation of their group identity by saying or thinking specifically.
Superficially.
Oh, superficially, I'm sorry. He's a gay guy, or she's an Asian woman, or they are black or white.
Yeah. Keep going.
Oh.
Yeah, finish the paragraph.
So much is driven by the perception that we have, and by now these perceptions then fuel certain thoughts, emotions, and beliefs. However, if we were not meant to be simple summations or to be seen with casual eyes, we must be willing to look closer to see what else is there, to see beyond the glossy print or fixed perceptions to the nuances, the subtle gradation, the treasure in the understated, even the forbidden. The discernment begins with our minds and hearts. We can become more mindful of our perceptions and use them as invitations to look more deeply at our racial habits of mind.
Buddhist teachings refer to misrepresentations as perceptual knots, ways of viewing that block freedom and keep us entangled in knotty thoughts. It's like a pun intended.
Yes.
There.
Okay.
These misrepresentations include our attachments, aversions, distortions, delusions. They keep us thinking that life is personal and permanent and that it should be perfect. One teaching in particular, the Vipassala or Vipalasa Sutta, yeah, speaks to the reinforcing mechanism of misperceiving, ways we distort reality to the detriment of belonging. Simply stated, we perceive something through our senses. There's a sense organ and a sense object, eyes, ears, eyes see, ears hear, nose smells, body feels, tongue tastes, and mind thinks. Once we perceive, the mind habitually jumps to thoughts and feelings about what is being perceived. These thoughts and feelings are rooted in past experience and past conditioning. Thoughts and feelings then influence the mood of our mind. When perceptions, thoughts, and feelings are repeated or imprinted through experiences, they solidify into view or belief. View then reinforces perception. This cycle becomes a way in which we experience and respond to the world.
We have radically conditioned perceptions that operate based on past experiences stored in the mind. These include memories, views, beliefs, and fears, all of which stimulate the mind to act or behave in ways that make sense to us. Once we perceive race, the mind immediately scans the memory bank of past experiences to interpret what is being perceived. When we then add layers of meaning and the experience shifts from bare perceiving into something more textured and nuanced. When layered perceptions become distorted, sticky and weighty.
Essentially, we think we know something, and then we are off and running, all based on past experiences, preferences, and beliefs. And usually, but not always, it's all in our minds, or at a minimum, worthy of questioning. When we perceive and when thoughts and emotions are simultaneously activated, these thoughts and emotions proliferate, creating a state of fear and anxiety driven by what the mind is believing in that moment. In such moments, we are removed from presence. We vacate the premises of body and mind and are fixated on view. And the experience is real until it's not. We're streaming the past live.
We feel more reassured when our views are mirrored back to us, even if we don't like our views. We are on guard when our views are challenged. Views that don't align with our own go unnoticed. We stop being mindful when we think we know, and that's when much harm can happen.
Years ago, my mom, who taught through stories and music, told me a noteworthy joke. On a one-lane zigzagging mountain road, two black guys driving down the hill past two white officers driving up the hill, they shout out to the cops, "Pigs, pigs!" The police officers, pissed by the perceived attack, keep driving. Seconds later, the police officer who is driving must slam on his brakes to avoid a herd of pigs crossing the road. This is the cycle of misperception at play.
Perception determines the characteristics of what it perceives. For example, whether a race is threatening or whether a race is worth paying attention to. It determines whether we like someone or something and whether we shoot someone or run. What we see in race is not inherently good or bad, right or wrong. It is our judgment about race. That is problematic. We place judgment on what we perceive. We add layers of meaning.
There is much we can do. We can make a practice of questioning our perceptions and critiquing any views and beliefs that surface in our mind that work against clear seeing, belonging, and healing. We can choose to reevaluate our racial perceptions, thoughts, emotions, and beliefs. Try to recognize where they come from and strip them of all those extra layers. Until we are willing to examine our views of racial conditioning, we're flipping off a caution and could kill some pigs or end up dressing a mannequin in a penguin costume.
Understanding the cycle of misperception supports us in distinguishing habits of harm. How perception, thoughts, and emotions reinforce views is an important mechanism to recognize a useful way to begin questioning our perceptions and critiquing views and beliefs that work against racial literacy, harmony, and freedom. Mindfulness can help us recognize the cycle of misperception and use our perceptions as invitations to look deeper, to unknot the inner distress and racial habits of harm, so that our response to outer racial suffering can be attended to more wisely. So this morning, we're going to do a little bit of just looking at different views, different ways that perhaps we don't see the impact of these different views that we have, or even to see views that we may have that we didn't know that we had. So that's the exploration. And one other thing I wanted to mention was in this sutta, and Andy Olinsky mentions it as well, there's a there's a kind of a reference to saying that when we have these distortions or inversions or perversions of mind, perception and view, it's like having a mind that's deranged, or as Andy would say, that we don't have mental health, we have mental illness. And that by actually clearing up our minds of these distortions, clearing our perceptions of these distortions, and clearing our views of these distortions is like having mental health. So even though this particular article that we read from Ruth King is based on racial perceptions and racial views, that can be across the whole spectrum of how we see things in our lives. And perhaps our perceptions of when my significant other says this, it means that. And we may have habitual patterns that we don't pay attention to, that we formed views around, that need to be unknotted. And I love that little play on words of knotty, K-N-O-T-T-Y, that we might also hear as naughty. So let me check with all of you. Is this okay to maybe take a short break here? And then we'll come back.